Welcome to the BFM Historical Society. This week, we talk to Campbell Roy Smith, also known as Roy the Lawyer, the original host of Lawline. He explains to us what happened to the voice like gravel. Welcome to the BFM Historical Society, Campbell Roy Smith. Campbell, tell me, when did you first get involved with the radio station?
I think early 90s, maybe 1993. I'd been a fan. I grew up in Hamilton and cultural wasteland as it was. Maybe not so now, but it definitely was then. And just I came up here to go to university, and it was a huge light went off. You'd hang out in the quad much more, I think, in those days than the kids do now. I think we didn't work so hard. And it was broadcast over the quad. I don't know if that still happens, but you could hear it. And so it was all this music that I really loved and loved learning about new artists that you certainly couldn't get on any other radio station. And so I was always kind of around, hanging around here. But I got involved the first time when Marcus was on his first and, I guess, his breakfast. And Marcus and I kind of... We're acquainted with each other from, I don't know, actually, just from hanging around, being at university, working in bars, or he worked in a bar that I hung out in. And I think we were at a party one night, and we were definitely drunk. And, you know, he just started that stint, and he said, oh, you know, you should come up and be on the radio and give, you know, legal advice, which sounded like a genius idea at the time, you know, when you've had a few beers and you're all sort of, you know, happy and bouncy. Oh, yeah, that sounds brilliant. I'll come up and do that. The gap between that party ending and the stopping of the drinking and coming on air the next day wasn't very large. And I remember coming up here thinking, you know, I was sober and thinking, I've only been a lawyer for a couple of years and I have no idea what possibly people could ask. So I sort of was shitting myself a bit. So I thought, well, I just can't use my name. Would been Campbell Smith, so I decided that my middle name being Roy, I thought, well, I'll just call myself Roy. And Marcus decided that Roy the Lawyer sounded good, and that's where it started. So I came on air as Roy the Lawyer. I guess I maybe overestimated the audience too, not to be disrespectful to the great BFM Unwashed out there, but I was sort of thinking, you know, there'd be gnarly issues relating to really complex legal concepts. And really, from the very get-go, it was really always about drugs and traffic and sometimes property and fence disputes. And they were just real everyday problems that people had. They weren't actually difficult to answer most of the time because it was mostly common sense, you know. I can't remember if it was actually Marcus or it was one of the other breakfast hosts, and they sort of have a crack at answering them and make a complete hash of it. So there was a degree of common sense that I perhaps had that they didn't have. The hardest thing about it was sort of keeping Marcus quiet. But the ones I remember were the absurd ones. And so absurd that you'd think they're pulling my leg. You know, there's kids laughing around a phone at home making a crank call. One of them was to do with AK-47s, a man who had a collection of illegal guns. And was concerned how to transport his guns around town, where he could or couldn't store them without being detected. These guns are all, of course, completely illegal, and no one was supposed to have them, but that seemed to be by the by. My favourite one, though, was the chap who ran up, and I'm sure this wasn't a joke because he did it too well. He said, I understand that when you're involved in a court case and evidence is presented, that if you are the owner of that evidence, that once it's been presented in the case, then, you know, that evidence would get returned to you. Like, you know, I don't... thinking about some piece of, you know, clothing or something, perhaps like that. And he goes, I said, yeah, generally that would be what happens. And he goes, well, I was arrested for possession of marijuana, and I've been to court, and they had my marijuana, and they presented it and said, this is what I was in possession of, and I was found guilty and stuff, and now it's all over. I just want to know how I get my marijuana back from the police. But he did it in such a way that I'm sure it wasn't a joke. It was so beautifully paced and timed that, you know, this... And he literally thought he could go down to the police station and fetch back an ounce bag. Yeah. Those are the ones that sort of remained with me. Not really so much the serious ones. I guess they kind of probably dealt with them at the firm and did the job. But those ones were the ones that kind of always, you know, remained with me. The kind of the weird and wacky ones where you would. Marcus and I, or Graham and I, or Mikey, or Hugh, whoever was the host, would sort of look at each other and try to gauge whether someone at the end was going to laugh at us. But that was, I guess, what was most entertaining about it, was just these kind of everyday problems that people had, and then some of the perceptions that they had about how the law did work. Those ones you'd think common sense had sort of somewhat escaped that fellow.
How long did Lawline go for?
Well, it's still going now, right?
Well, yes, of course.
Did it until... See, what happened, my entire career, I now really don't practice law, but I manage bands and I promote tours and shows, and my whole career has been about the music industry. And it really did begin here. As I was saying to you before, I kind of came up here and started hanging out up here and started working with these musicians. I started managing the Tufnells, and then I started, you know, advising a bunch of them, the other musicians legally. And, you know, I eventually segued out of law. I still continued to negotiate contracts and stuff, but I ended up becoming a manager and managing, you know, lots of bands. And there were lots of things that came up that weren't inside my particular skill set. I have no idea about how to transfer property or, you know, tax laws or things like that. So whenever they come up, I would just give them the number of a firm that I was working at, and they would call up there and get it sorted out. So, and that was interesting because the firm that I work for were a little bit sort of reticent about how good an idea this was. Actually, they didn't even understand it. You know, BFM, what is that? And what are you going to do? And how's this going to work? And don't use our name anywhere. Until, you know, I started feeding all these clients through, and then they thought it was the best thing ever. As you know better than anyone, kind of BFM, once it gets in your blood and you sort of end up, you spend so much time there. I would have that Thursday morning slot where I'd come up and do that. But then I started spending more and more time here, not, I think, doing anything other than kind of hanging out. It's a great place to hang out. It always was. You know? And all these ideas, and it was sparking all the time amongst everyone that worked up here. And you had to have your wits about you to kind of be up here and be involved in even a conversation. It was always so sort of sharp and active. I guess I'd been a lawyer for maybe about 3 or 4 years when I started doing this. So I was in my mid to late 20s. I'd become a lawyer. I don't really know why. I think, actually, you know, I fell in love with a girl in law school. I wasn't even at law school, and I sort of became infatuated with this girl. So I swapped out of a commerce degree and went into a law intermediate. So my entire career as a lawyer is predicated or based on this lust for this girl. I don't even know her name. I never met her, I don't think. So what was I saying? I went to law school, and I didn't really quite know why I was a lawyer. So I worked for a huge law firm, and I'd always been interested in music. So I thought, you know, I could try to parlay that into something to do with the law, and into something to do with the music. And you work in a big law firm, you don't really get that chance. And then I went to a smaller law firm where I was doing, I guess, a more varied amount of work. Lots of drugs, actually. I wasn't doing lots of drugs. I was actually acting for a lot of people who had drug charges. Well, actually, probably both. And so I was looking for this way to kind of make the law more interesting for me. And then I started, you know, hanging out up here and hanging out. And there's just, the place was always full of musicians. You know, it was constantly full of musicians. And so, and doing the Roy the Lawyer thing kind of gave me a degree of credibility with them. Warranted or not, it just did.
Also, I guess at that time, there weren't an awful lot of lawyers specializing in entertainment law.
Well, there were kind of none. There was one. There was a guy called Malcolm Black, who's since become a, you know, a very good friend of mine. And there wasn't anyone else. But then you couldn't learn it either. You know, people would come to you for advice. And I literally would have meetings with them, and then I'd be going, yes, you know, sort of nodding sagely. And then they'd leave, and I'd go and get books from the library, and I'd, you know, learn up about these things. It was kind of like that. But I had this sort of weird juxtaposition at the law firm where I'd come to BFM and I'd wear a suit. And I don't know why. I think because perhaps I wanted to look like the lawyer. I wanted the people who I wanted to work with to see me that way and think, you know, he's here and he kind of is sort of one of us, but, you know, he's a straight guy who can be a lawyer. On the other hand, I was going to work, and it was getting worse and worse. I cut down my hours to 3 days a week. I told them that it didn't really feel right to me that I should wear a suit. And, I mean, I ended up going to work in jeans. Just basically my ass was hanging out of. My hair was really long. I didn't shave. And so I was going to the conservative law firm dressed like a, you know, a complete wastrel. And I was coming up to BFM in a suit with a tie on trying to look respectable. It was a very odd twist to end up in that sort of situation.
Now, I want to talk about the voice, because Roy the Lawyer had a very distinctive voice on the radio. And in fact, I remember the promo said, "With a voice like gravel, he'll save you from the gavel."
That's true. I've forgotten about that. I had nodules on my vocal cords is where that came from. My mother would say it, so I sounded like a concrete mixer, and she didn't think that was a good thing. But yeah, I did, and it turned out to be, I guess, a really intriguing and interesting radio voice. But yeah, I had nodules on one of my vocal cords, which meant that I wasn't actually ever speaking properly. I was actually, rather than my vocal cords vibrating, I was just sucking air past one of them. That was body adapts, I guess. But the interesting thing about that was, you know, you're on radio, you know you're on radio, and you know people can't see you, but you, of course, know what you look like, and you think, well, people will think I look like I do. But of course, people didn't. And I think Graham ran this competition once that you had to draw me. It was all based on the voice. Well, these pictures came in and they were fucking terrifying. Literally none of them would have depicted anyone under the age of 110. Most of them had, almost all the pictures had a cigarette hanging out of my mouth and a glass of whiskey. It was like, I was sort of like Rumpole of the Bailey crossed with, I don't know, you know, some sort of Terminator or something. And it really gave me quite a kick, you know, not a good kick. I was like, I don't look like this. I need to let people see my face. But of course, no one ever cared about that. So that was the voice. And then I eventually had to have an operation because they were worried they were cancerous, so they cut them out. And
so the doctor said, "Oh, you need to get these.
You can't." I'm like, "No, it's my voice. I'm on the radio. I have to have it." And they cut them out, and perhaps maybe that was the beginning of the end. Maybe that was Samson having his hair cut off. But I think I did that about mid-90s. I had them cut out. Sorry. The first song is by a band called The Tufnells, which is the very first band that I started managing. And it's a song called Husky Vooms. It's a song I like because it was the hook of the song is a line that says, "Wouldn't you like to see me?" And one of the guys in the band that wrote it was going to a gym at the time, and he thought this girl was giving him the eye. Every time he went there, he thought this girl was giving him the eye. It turns out, though, she was blind.
Right, I want to talk a little bit about Marcus now. It turns out he was actually only hosting The Breakfast Show for a couple of years, and yet it seems like an entire era. There was never any doubt that when he decided to move on, you were going to carry on doing Lawline.
No, there wasn't a doubt at all. I guess at that stage, I'd become very immersed here as well. I was on air doing the Roy the Lawyer thing, which I was loving doing. I loved being on the radio with Marcus. I loved being the sort of the side guy. I loved being the Ed McMahon to the Johnny Carson. It was great. You didn't have to carry the thing, but you could be kind of funny and add value to it. At the same time, I was doing midnight to dawn shifts and trying to do talkback as well, but I was never really any good at that. because I wasn't actually good at doing that. In fact, the talkback I did was dire, awful. No one ever hears that again. As I said, this place was so chock full of creative people, and I think it always has been. But it was about a time when I guess there was a bit of a move away from just being the creative place, and there was a bit more pressure on it, BFM, to be, I think, a little bit more commercially standalone. And the AUSA, the Students Union, which owned the station, was, I guess, expecting a return rather than just expecting to fund it. So there was a board in place, and it was trying to run the place, I guess, more professionally. So I came in here and I was a lawyer, and they'd never had a lawyer, so I just sort of got co-opted onto the board. There wasn't any degree of quality control of this, you know. So I joined the board. So at that stage, and like I say, I was hanging out here all the time. My friends were all here. I was doing the law line thing, joined the board. I ended up becoming the chairman of the board for a period of time. So I was in BFM, you know, it felt like for life. So when Marcus left, he was like a supernova, really, Marcus. He just sort of, he burned so brightly for, you know, a really short, I guess a short period of time, but it did seem like a little longer. But yeah, never any doubt that I would stay. Mm. As long as, I guess, the new host was into it. But so it was a pretty successful segment. And it's pretty amazing. And it sort of sounds like Marcus had some great plan, but I can tell you he didn't. He was just, like you say, he'd run into people that he knew, or you know, like we did in a bar. Come on. There were the guys that were on every day, Jennifer and Alistair. Alistair, crazy dude, really cool guy. And I came on Thursdays. There was, you know, I guess Russell was on Fridays doing hard news. There was all these things going on that made for, I think, a really entertaining breakfast show that he planted all of that and then left. Went to do Nightline or something, didn't he? Yeah. Honestly, I mean, as good as Marcus was in that supernova kind of way, Graham, to my mind, was the consummate breakfast toaster. Listening to BFM before Marcus took over from Graham, and, you know, before I got involved myself, I could listen to him. He was smart, intelligent. He'd challenge you when you were listening to the station. Obviously, the music was always great, but I think that stint that Graham did up until Marcus was really, I think, the best it's probably ever been on breakfast. I think Graham came back after Marcus, but he was probably, you know, I don't know if he really wanted to or if it was really driving. He's always had a great degree of, well, not a great degree, a slight degree of being unhinged, Graham, which is, I think, what made him so brilliant. But I think, you know, when he was getting too stressed, perhaps it was a bit much. I saw him the other night. I went to see a friend of mine in hospital, and Graham turned up wearing a pink dress and a builder's hat. So he still is somewhat unhinged. But the thing about the dress, pink it was, lovely pink dress, but it was filthy. And it had love written across the midriff. But he was, I think, just genius, a genius breakfast toast. He really was. I think I did Lawline until perhaps 1997. And at that stage, I went overseas. I went to London with, I was managing Garageland and Beck Ronger. And I left then to do that. I don't think I would have left BFM had I not left the country. They would have probably had to push me out of here because I was so at home here. It felt so comfortable. And, you know, you felt constantly challenged here. So I developed this entire management career, and it really came from here. It really came from that kind of credibility I got, as I say, rightly or wrongly, but it came from being here and being amongst them and kind of being one of them. So that was it. So, mid 1997, I think. And at that stage, I was chairing the board as well. So I had stopped doing that and stopped doing Lawline. And funnily enough, Chris Hockard, who I said to Chris, come and do the Lawline. You should take over from that. He's, I think, still the chairman of the board as well. So he kind of, you know, took both those roles too. So, you know, this cool creative haven that BFM is, you know, it's always been run by lawyers for the last 15 years.
How did you know him?
How did I know Chris? Just about town, really. We were young lawyers about the same age. Chris, I think, is slightly older than me. I think he's about 10 years older than me. That's not true, just in case he's listening. we were kind of just working in the same area. And I guess probably with a like-minded love of music, love of local music. So we sort of, I guess, knew each other from that. We weren't your everyday suits and cufflinks kind of lawyers. This is Darcy Clay, who, speaking of supernovas, I guess probably the most genius musician, I think, that was hanging around here at the time. And there were a lot of them, but that kid had something really, really special. And obviously such a shame what happened with him. But this song, I think, very, very vivid memory from my time hanging out up here. Jesus, I was evil.
I used to do lots of things.
I used to do things and I'd say things and Jesus, I was evil. Take things and break things and Jesus, I was evil. I never shook babies, I never beat no ladies.
My office was in the apartment and they had above Thresherman's Bakery on K Road. It was everybody came in and out of there because the door was always open. And, you know, we were, I guess, living life large in those days, you know, we weren't sleeping a lot. And so the, you know, the girls working on the street would be coming up and the musicians would be coming in and out. And oftentimes there'd be problems every now and again, stray, angry people would come in. But once Aaron Carson, actually, who became a station manager up here, had to clobber someone with my ironing board to get them out of there. Actually, Aaron Carson created quite a bit of damage in that apartment. He broke the toilet, pulled the cistern off the wall and were involved in some tryst with one of the midday hosts, actually.
Probably, Steve Simpson.
Probably wasn't Steve Simpson. I think it was definitely a female. He'll love me for saying that. But that apartment was part of it as well. That was, like you say, the musicians were just constantly coming in and out of there all the time. It was good fun. Well, this is Finger Pops. This is Garageland, and I think this is a consummate pop song. It was the first big hit Garageland had on BFM, and it was roughly about that time that I started managing them.
I drive my car up to the lake as if there's someone to awake. I haven't been to bed for days. I live in a twilight haze. And I set my heart to the setting sun, and I hope that no one else has done it. And the drinks are never fun. Open up the bar. I miss you every single day. I wait until I know your way. I hate the way I feel down to these different ways.
I love the way your fingers pop.
So I left BFM and New Zealand in 97. I went to London with Garageland. I'd been managing them, I guess, for about a year or maybe a year and a half. We'd signed a deal with them, with Mushroom in the UK. And there was quite a bit of buzz about them. That song, Finger Pops, was a top 10 NME hit. They were picked to really do well. So we moved them and based them in the UK, and I went there with them. So it was full on managing then, really. It was being based with the band in the UK and being a manager. I sort of stopped lawyering other than for my own artists, and that was, I guess, a new phase of my life and my career. I was with Garageland in the US and the UK for about a year and a half, and then I took them to the US, and about the same time Beck Runger moved up there as well. We released her first record here in New Zealand in 97, and we released that in the US in 98. So 98, 99, I was based in New York. With Garageland coming and going from the UK, and Beck was living there at the time as well. And it was a period of constantly touring. Both those artists were on the road all the time. So I saw a lot of the world in those years, but it's a really weird view of the world. You basically see airports, buses, and hotels and venues. So you go to a lot of places, but you know, if someone said to me, "Have you been to Tunisia?" I can say, "Yes, I have," but I've not seen anything of it. It was kind of a weird life, but good fun. And it was kind of like, I guess it was what my career had become. It's what I ended up being, and I still am, I guess, an artist manager. And so yeah, a couple of years on the road. I think I came back here in 2000. Greatly pleased to discover that BFM was still the great thing it always had been. People had come and gone. I think you and I were talking before about how when I was on the board, we would sit at board meetings and think, God, how can we replace Bob Kerrigan? Who can ever write ad copy that good? But people do come and people do go, and new people come in. And this, so to come back and find that this great institution was still as good as it ever was reassuring. And then from 2000, I guess, just building the management company, started managing more and more bands, and started promoting shows. And I think in 2004 we took over the Big Day Out. So taking over the Big Day Out really reinforced the relationship with BFM. Obviously it's a strong BFM. Big Day Out has had a relationship from the get-go, so that was kind of nice to be back in the fold in that way again.
Lawyers have very good incomes. Traditionally, artist managers are kind of at the whim of how well their artists are doing in terms of concerts and record sales and things like that. So obviously at some point you had to decide, right, I'm not going to do law anymore. I'm going to focus full time on this thing. Were you worried?
Nah, because you're assuming that I was a lawyer who made a lot of money. And I really wasn't. I mean, you know what? I always like to law what BFM is perhaps like to commercial radio.
Oh, okay.
What I loved about my law is that I was doing what I love, which was working with bands and musicians and advising them. But musicians don't have any money.
Yeah.
So I was, I had a few jobs that made a bit of money. And I guess by quantity I was earning a little bit. But really, I wasn't making a lot of money. I always feel really pleased to be able to look back on my career and go that no decisions I ever made, crucial ones, were made based on making money. I would still be in the big law firm doing, tax and living in some giant house and be bored out of my brain. I had a great life. I had great friends. I hung out and worked and was lucky enough to work with these really, really talented, amazing people. A lot of who became my friends, my closest friends now all kind of came through. Paul Cassidy, another genius, bald, but a genius. They're all still my friends today, and a lot of them came through here. So that decision to go from being a lawyer to being a full-on manager, I probably made more money being a manager than I ever did being a lawyer. So that's probably the flip of that. Look, I got to go and travel the world, hang out with my mates, and be involved in making music with them. It really was a no-brainer, really. I had no obligations, I guess, either. I had no mortgage or children or anything like that to worry about. So it didn't seem to me to be a tough decision. And it worked. I mean, I guess I'm comfortable enough now, and I've always been able to do what I wanted to do. And like I say, it really came from here. It really came from finding that way in at BFM. And it's kind of led to everything that I've been able to do. Oh, well, this is the 3Ds, who I guess amazing band. You think of those twin guitars, those twin searing guitars, and I guess that's mostly the sound you associate with the 3Ds. But this song is called Beautiful Things, and Denise sings in it. It's just a gorgeous, lovely, un-3D-like song, I think.
you live semi-permanently overseas and somehow manage to have a year-round summer. Explain how that works.
That's well planned. That's my single biggest achievement, having a year-round summer. Well, I'm here. I come back. I'm in New Zealand from September to March, where we do the music awards, which I run through Rianne's, and then the big day out, which is pretty constant work from September to January. That's in January, and then I have the winery tour that we do through New Zealand wineries in February, and then I go back to LA in March, and I'm based there from March to September, pretty much. It's just, over the last few years, we've just decided to start putting out the records of our artists directly. I guess in the digital era and in this environment, we can do that. We don't necessarily need to work through, a traditional record company. So I'm based in LA for that period, and we've been putting out our own records, and it's been going so well so far. And like you say, to have summer all year round is cool. And my wife lives there pretty much all the time, so we kind of come and go. But I'm apparently difficult to live with, so seemingly it works well that for half the year I'm not annoying her.
She gets a break.
Yeah. And it's cool. And, I guess over the years of I have a pretty strong network of friends and business colleagues that I've worked with over the last 15 years in the US. So, we've got a pretty good base there. And it's good to be able to maintain that as well. It's good to be able to make the music here in New Zealand. But you really do need to have the musicians and the infrastructure around the musicians needs to have, if you want to try to succeed internationally, you need to have a good network of people who can, help you and give you breaks and put you in the right direction and stuff. So it's good to be able to maintain that, those relationships.
Do you listen to the radio over in the States?
I listen to New Zealand radio online. Not all the time. Just, I guess when I need a fix of bastardized vowels, I'll have a listen here. National radio I like to listen to, as well as BFM. The radio in the US, very difficult to listen to be honest. I mean, the mainstream radio is kind of hard. KCRW, which I guess is a PBS station that's very similar to BFM, I guess, in where it stands. But kind of like a BFM national radio cross. Public radio is there. I listen to that through the middle of the day whenever I'm driving. You spend a lot of time in a car in LA, but no music. That's pretty much just news and information and current affairs. Last year, being in the US through the initially through the primaries between Clinton and Obama, that was intriguing, listening to that on the radio, the coverage of that. That was way more interesting, I think, than ultimately the McCain-Obama race was. That Clinton-Obama one was really cool. So listen to that, and then, the K-Rocks of the world are just almost unlistenable. I really find it. I mean, apart from I don't really like the music so much, I don't really like the sound of the DJs. They had an indie station called Indie 103, and they had Steve Jones from the Sex Pistols DJ'd from noon to 2 every day. That was good to listen to. Because if ever a man wasn't born to be a DJ, but strangely enough, it was brilliant radio work, it was Steve Jones. And he would just talk nonsense in that sort of drawling English accent. And, it's 12 bells. And, yeah, he was good fun to listen to. But mostly he'd play new tunes and just be befuddled by it. Well, this is a band someone gave me to play. And he'd run a competition. You'd have to call up and say whether it was mustard, which meant hot, or pants, which meant shit. So is it mustard or pants? He would say. I think the Americans were bemused by him as well. It's just, Steve Jones from the Sex Pistols, but yeah, as Americans are often about a lot of people who aren't from America, they're bemused by them.
Explain to us a little bit your role at Rianne's and what that sort of job entails.
Well, I took that Rianne's job, and I guess that was born out of wanting to, constantly representing artists. I thought if I took on that Rianne's job, I didn't think it had been done very well for a while. The Industry Association, Recording Industry Association of New Zealand, represents people who make sound recordings. So that's recording artists as well as record companies. And I thought that perhaps that association hadn't really been sticking up enough for the rights of particularly recording artists. And in this era, more recording artists are owning their own recordings. They're not necessarily owned by a record company that they're, enslaved to. They own their own, and they may distribute through companies, but, they own their own recordings. So I wanted to look after the rights of my musicians and all the other musicians that were making music here. So I took that job on, and I thought the music awards would die. In fact, the last one that was the shittest music awards ever was actually hosted by Marcus. It was at the St. James, and honestly, it was a shameful, shameful representation of our industry. Not because of him. I mean, he was crap as well, but the whole thing was just ass. So I thought, well, we've got to do something about that. So we've revamped the music awards to now it it's at the Victor Arena, and I think is a really healthy, positive celebration of New Zealand music. That was good to do. And then other things we've been doing, don't get too complicated, I'm sure this isn't really the forum, but just protecting copyright, just the online peer-to-peer file sharing that's sort of decimating creative industries. And, you know, it's a big topic. People have opinions, and that's great. And so I've been working over the last couple of years to try to find a way through, try to find an answer that respects creativity and isn't too, you know, isn't too excessive, I guess, a response to the problem. So dealing with piracy and trying to protect copyright. But also, on the other hand, it's difficult as a kid growing up in this country. You just don't, no one talks to you about copyright. No one, you don't get taught that in school, and no one comes and says to you, this is what copyright is, and this is why it's important that we respect it. And if you want to be a musician or a writer or a film director or a producer or an actor, it's going to be important to you, and you're going to, you know, need to have that protection. So we want to try to get into schools and start talking to kids about why it's, why it should be respected, and why you shouldn't, you know, cheat creative people out of income. So those, I guess, are the kind of key things that we're doing at Rianne's right now. And it's been a different kind of challenge. It's oftentimes corporate. I spent a lot of time in Wellington talking to politicians, which, you know, can be draining. Actually can be draining. It just is draining. It reminds me a lot of being in court, that whole, you know what you know in court, you know what you want to say, but you've got to go through this ridiculously archaic system, hierarchy of, you know, of rules and laws. And I mean, I do have a great deal of respect for a lot of them, but sometimes you don't, and you find yourself having to, you know, toe the line, I guess, to try to achieve things. But yeah, the Rianne's thing has been interesting. And yeah, it's kind of cool that I'm allowed to do it. They've let me continue to do that without being in the country for half the year.
I know, that's amazing.
Yeah. Sort of thing. I get a lot more done, funnily enough, there than here, just by dint of the fact that I don't have to have meetings. But yeah, not having to, when you look at your diary all day and you can actually sit at a desk and work without having to, you know, get through five meetings, you know, save a lot of time. I'm still really driven about my artists, the artists that I, well, not just the ones that I represent, but I'm driven to, I don't want to sound too pious, but I'm really driven to better the lot of local musicians. And you know, while I still kind of feel driven to do that, I guess I still will. I think the thing that we always try, well, I always try to remember, is that the problems that we have caused by the internet, caused by the ease at which you can, you know, illegally download music, by far exceeding that problem is the opportunity that the internet provides. And, you know, like I'm saying before, being able to be in America and release our artists' records ourselves, we can only really do that because of the digital world. So far more opportunities abound and are placed before us than I think hindrances. So I'll keep doing it. Mm. as long as people listen to me, then I guess I'll keep trying to do what I do. Well, this is from Super Red, and I think I picked this song Saskatchewan because it's from, I think, maybe the best Flying Nun album of that period. You know, with due respect to my own bands, I just think that Super Red album was just cracking.
You're not an epic, go on and your fucking mind, Saskatchewan.
Russell Brown and I commentated the 1995 Rugby World Cup, the Cup with Jonah Lomu and South Africa, and it was how it came about I don't know, but it all comes down to the genius of Rick Huntington. Basically, it was again in that apartment of mine on K Road. Rick came in with a toolbox and a lunchbox and some cardboard rolls and made a radio station, as he's wont to do. But what he can make a radio out with, a piece of soap and a bottle top, it's ridiculous talent. Made an outside broadcast, was climbing on my roof and putting things up. He's such a mad little genius. And so we had a big screen TV. And basically, Russell and I would just sit there with a microphone each, watch the TV, and I had Murray Deeker from ZB in my ear. I had like a one earpiece, so Russell and I would actually have somebody who knew something about what they were doing. He was speaking in my ear, and we would commentate. And I guess it was kind of like Marcus's breakfast show, really. Just through the games that we did, people would come and sit in the room. So in the end, we'd have a considerable amount of people who were sort of sitting around us as we were commentating this game. Doug Hood, for old Doug, who kept falling asleep and snoring throughout, so you hear this muffled snoring. My father came up and he became a sort of a comic party. All the commentary is always involved looking for my father, who was riddled with Alzheimer's and was wandering around somewhere. But it was enormous fun. Really hard work. I mean, how people commentate, right? It's just, obviously full on the whole time. But, Russell and I would share it between us. And it was all sort of euphoric, really, because we were winning and, Lomu was this sort of giant,
unstoppable.
Overnight. And then the final came along and I don't think any of us ever thought that we could possibly lose the game. I think even as we were commentating, it was all just a matter of time before, this Lomu ran all over everybody again and we won. And we lost it. It was so deflating. I think TV One News were there covering it, covering these two crazy idiots from VFM who were commentating the rugby by watching the telly and talking into microphones. I just remember it being really deflating. Another one of the weird and strange things that went on in that particular apartment as people kind of constantly came and went. And the feedback was amazing. People loved it. People thought it was terrific. And I think, Russell and I did talk about doing it again, but it never came about.
I'd like your thoughts just on why you think BFM's managed to last as long as it has, and also, where you think BFM needs to be looking in the future.
It's had an enduring spirit for as long as, from when I first became aware of it and the years I've been involved in, and I guess the years out of it looking back, I think it's just, it has had this enduring spirit about it, this almost life of its own, almost no matter what anyone else does, anyone who has charge of it at any particular point in time does to it, it seems to come through. It's held very close by so many people. So many people are so protective of that spirit and of what BFM is and what it does that it seems to, lead this sort of protected life. It's still, I think, a place that young people who don't even necessarily have an interest in broadcasting, just kind of want to hang out with like-minded people, can come and seemingly get involved. I think that's still, having that openness about it is special. The people coming and going thing, no one ever, we've talked about Rick, but he's a case apart, but no one ever really stays in pivotal roles beyond their use by date. There are some terrific DJs, yourself included, who've been constantly working here, but program directors and station managers and that, they roll through and they kind of take what they give what they give and they take what they take and they move on. So I think that's been really important. How you maintain that and where BFM ought to be looking, I don't know. It's kind of like magic. It's alchemy in a way, really, to be able to, as soon as you start trying to figure out why it is and what it needs to do, I think that might be the magic gone. But as long as people with a love for this place and a love for what it does and continue to want to be involved with it, then I think it's reasonably safe. There is a hugely crowded radio market, but it occupies a pretty special place within it, and I don't think anything else is like it. Anything else kind of challenges it. All those people, even people, the people moving away overseas, now online you can hear it, you can get it wherever you are around the world. So it's kind of got, I guess an added lease of life too with that it's, accessible all around the world. So that's kind of a rambling answer, but I guess more than anything, I think the spirit that permeates this place. Yeah, interesting. I'm involved in a huge radio case arguing about this right now, but there's no doubt about the fact that, radio does, expose artists. And, when I first started working at BFM, it would be fair to say that commercial radio didn't really have a lot of interest in New Zealand artists. And, this place was massively, crucially important in exposing artists. It still is today. So, yeah, there's, long may it live and long, I'm sure we'll never be tired of it and I'm sure we'll never grow too old of it and I'm sure we'll always want it. Oh, just this last song is by Shaft, who I've always thought of as a quintessential BFM band, awesomely cool band. And this song, Downhill Racer, just live, always made the party start. So this is Shaft, Downhill Racer.
Ever since I was a kid.
You have been listening to the BFM Historical Society, a weekly radio documentary series made to commemorate BFM's 40th anniversary. The Historical Society airs every Saturday morning at 11 a.m. and is posted on BFM's website as a podcast later on in the week. BFM Historical Society is produced at BFM by Dubhead.